I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and I'm here with my guest, Perry Nyes.
Marlena is the name I gave my Grotrian Steinweg 6-foot grand piano, because when I first played her, I said, if Marlena Dietrich were to be reincarnated as a piano, she would be this one, because she had this dark, throaty, sultry, seductive voice. There's kind of a metaphor going on there that runs through the book about the piano as a beautiful, unattainable woman. It's sort of girl meets piano, girl loses piano, girl gets piano back, you know, the old Hollywood story. And there's a film Marlena Dietrich made in the 20s called The Blue Angel, where she breaks the heart of a professor who gives up everything for her. And the song that she sings is Falling in Love Again, Never Wanted to, What Am I to Do, I Can't Help It. And for me, that was an emblematic story that seemed to fit my own, because I was like Emil Jannings in the thrall of a piano, and I couldn't understand what had happened to me and why I would throw my life over for an instrument when I didn't even play all that well. The experience of playing that piano is a transcendent experience. It's an experience of traveling into the beyond, as my friend who inspired the book, the technician Mark Wienert, says. He said, I wasn't looking for what most pianists are looking for. I was looking to ride the crest of the wave of the expanding universe. And that's what that experience was about. So you could say that it brought me a little bit further on my developmental journey as a human being. I fell madly in love with the characters I met over and over again. And I think thinking that my readers will fall in love with these people too. They're passionate. They love what they do. They themselves are vibrating as beings on a very elevated frequency. And we resonated to each other when we met.
Perry Nyes is an award-winning environmental policy reporter whose articles and essays have appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, Audubon, Sports Illustrated, Condé Nast Traveler, and Outside. She was educated in philosophy and Russian at the University of Michigan, studied piano at Mann's College of Music, volunteered as a wilderness ranger on the Beaverhead National Forest, and received her master's degree in journalism at Columbia University. Welcome, Perry.
Thank you, Anthony.
And you've written a book called Grand Obsession. And the first question I wanted to ask, did you ever find out?
Did I ever find out what?
What it was that makes Marlena such a heartbreaker. And tell us who Marlena is.
Marlena is the name I gave my Grotrian Steinweg 6-foot grand piano, because when I first played her, I said, if Marlena Dietrich were to be reincarnated as a piano, she would be this one, because she had this dark, throaty, sultry, seductive voice. And there's kind of a metaphor going on there that runs through the book about the piano as a beautiful, unattainable woman. It's sort of girl meets piano, girl loses piano, girl gets piano back, you know, the old Hollywood story. And there's a film Marlena Dietrich made in the 20s called The Blue Angel, where she breaks the heart of a professor who gives up everything for her. And the song that she sings is Falling in Love Again, Never Wanted to, What Am I to Do, I Can't Help It. And for me, that was an emblematic story that seemed to fit my own, because I was like Emil Jannings in the thrall of a piano, and I couldn't understand what had happened to me and why I would throw my life over for an instrument when I didn't even play all that well.
So did you figure it out?
Well, it's a complicated question to answer, Anthony.
Yes.
Because there's many different layers to answering that question. There's the physical. There's, you know, how the piano's built, the design that it was built with, who built it, the materials that were used. And those things are kind of mundane. But they add up to something that's very mysterious, which you can't really quantify or explain. I sort of went down the rabbit hole, to use another story, to try to get to the bottom of that question. And I found two things. One is, yes, I can answer the question of what it is that creates the experience, because I learned enough about engineering and piano technology to understand what the instrument does on that level, and physics, and metaphysics, and quantum physics, and all those things are related. But on another level, we'll never know. It's an unanswerable question. It's a question that is not in any encyclopedia.
And if I may be asking too intimate a question, let me know, but how did she change you? What did you discover about yourself from coming to know Marlena?
Well, the experience of playing that piano is a transcendent experience. It's an experience of traveling into the beyond, as my friend who inspired the book, the technician Mark Wienert, says. He said, I wasn't looking for what most pianists are looking for. I was looking to ride the crest of the wave of the expanding universe. And that's what that experience was about. So you could say that it brought me a little bit further on my developmental journey as a human being.
So most people aren't looking for that in music?
People are, not pianists.
Oh, really? What did you find that most pianists are looking for?
Well, I should say that this is what other people tell me. I don't claim to know the hearts and minds of all pianists.
Oh, sure.
But most professional pianists are being trained in a rigorous way, with a narrow focus, and they're playing mostly on instruments, since they don't have much money, they're mostly playing on instruments that are not well-maintained, often out of tune, often with regulation problems, often, you know, they're just pieces of wood. And they are not, they can't be having this kind of an experience because the instrument they're playing is just has not been brought to that level. And the extraordinary experience I was having was not just the music, and it certainly wasn't my capacity or skill as a pianist. It was about things that were happening with tonal vibration. And the reason those things were happening with tonal vibration in that piano is because a person and the people who built it, the person who tuned it, the people who built it, were attuned to a particular vibration, and they brought that to bear in the instrument because their passion is to create beauty in the world.
And that's the vibration you've sensed that they were attuned to?
That is what they do. But who they are as human beings is what the piano becomes. It's just like signature when you write your name. Nobody else can duplicate that. Or like a fingerprint. It was an collective expression of who they were. And they and I were kind of on the same frequency, as I discovered when I met them.
Because you actually went to the factories. This book is such a remarkable odyssey into the piano, but also into yourself and into the people who have gone together to make this piano what she is. And I think I'd like to begin, as some of the other interviews have, talk about your dad a little bit and your experience with him, because he taught you to listen, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. My father was a professional musician until I was about 6 months old. His last professional job was first clarinet at the Metropolitan Opera, and he was in a quintet in New York. And I grew up hearing him play the clarinet every day and working on his skills as a musician all his life, even when he went into business and was no longer professionally in music. He always had a chamber music group he played with or an amateur orchestra. And my father is an enthusiast. whatever it is he loves or is passionate about, he wants you to be love it and be passionate about it too. Whether it's fishing or camping or how to train dogs or building furniture or whatever it is, you know, or bicycles. He was crazy about bike racing for a while, and he got me a fabulous bike because, you know, he just sort of spins off his obsessions onto other people. But music was his greatest one of all. Music was like his religion. And it was a great gift. He imparted to me his lifelong understanding and his impeccable ear. He was a sound engineer and designed speaker systems, and he taught me to trust my ear. And that's something that most people don't have when they go to a concert or when they try out a piano, is they don't have the confidence in believing what they hear for themselves. They want another authority to tell them what's good. But I didn't have that issue myself, because from the time I was a toddler, I was being taught to trust my own hearing. And to, we would listen to the radio, and I would have to identify the orchestra and the conductor and the soloist and the composer. And then the announcer would come on, and we would wait to hear how much I had gotten right. And very often I did. So I learned how to trust my hearing.
How old were you at this time?
I was in grade school.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And I was my father's rehearsal coach many times. He trusted my hearing enough. This was another way of validating that I could hear, was how does this sound? How's this read? How's this passage? You know, and here I am 7 or 8 years old. And he took my opinions very seriously.
What can you offer to people, to our listeners, about how they might begin to do that if they have some sense that they'd like to?
Well, I would say that it's not something that's a gift. It's not something that only certain people have. We all have this ability. We just need someone to point out to us what to listen for. That's all he did. He'd say, notice this, notice that. And
you mean like qualities of tone?
Yeah, he'd say, qualities of tone, how themes would be repeated in music except in a different key. All the things that you might fly under your radar unless a knowledgeable person said, here's what you look for. And then, of course, you're going to hear it too. Anyone can hear this. It's just a matter of having an educated ear.
And you've been a reporter for magazines for, you said, 25 years?
Mm-hmm.
Did he teach you how to read, or how did you learn how to read and to understand how to be a good writer?
Well, I don't know. This must have just always been my calling, even though when I was a kid, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And I actually, it was not until I was in my late 20s that I decided I wanted to be a writer. I was doing lots of other things, music and art and acting and really into the outdoors, and I just didn't know what I wanted to do. But I started a novel when I was only 6 years old. My grandparents gave me a little pink manual typewriter for my birthday.
And oh, cool.
I immediately started writing a novel. And I was a voracious reader from a very young age. And it's just something I paid attention to, maybe not unlike the way in which I paid attention to music. You were not allowed in my house to simply have music on in the background. You had to sit and pay attention. And I think something of that sensibility probably was brought over to my reading, that I was not just a passive recipient of the words, I was paying attention to what was going on in the structure.
Because you spoke in your presentation last night, I went to a reading that you did in San Rafael. You said about writing, it was interesting for you to attend to how something was written while you're reading it, to say, how did the writer produce that? So we're going to have to take a short break here. I'm Anthony Wright. I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're talking with my guest, Perry Nyes. And how can people contact you, Perry?
My website is grandobsession.com. And if you go there, you'll find a synopsis of the book and some excerpts and links to other interesting piano sites and a news and events calendar and all the reviews that I've received and the book and has received. And that's grandobsession.com. There's a contact form. And if you fill it out, it will come directly to me.
Great. Well, we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. So stay tuned. I'm Anthony Wright and I'm your host today on Attunement. And we are talking with my guest, Perry Nyes. And Perry has written a book called Grand Obsession. I kind of like to append a subtitle, Meeting the Piano God.
Well, the subtitle actually is A Piano Odyssey.
A Piano Odyssey, okay.
Yes.
Before the break, we were talking about, as a writer, how you came to... it seems like you may have learned the craft of writing through reading. And you spoke about one of your authors, your favorite authors being Henry David Thoreau and some other people. How do good writers teach you about writing?
It's a lot easier to explain by pointing out particular passages. And that's something I do with my students when I teach writing, is I will find selections that are good examples, and then we talk about why it works, what's so good about it, what did they do. For example, a profile, I remember, that came out in The New Yorker of the guy who wrote Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, James Agee. He described how Agee was a long armature of bone and muscle, and you immediately get a picture in your mind of a body type, but he didn't. It's creating pictures in the mind, so that's maybe one thing, but you have to notice those things. It's also having the way cadence is used in sentences. I mean, actually, you can learn a lot about how to write from listening to good music, too. I had a professor at Columbia University who said he learned how to write by listening to Mozart. And because writing is music also. The sentences are phrases and themes or paragraphs, and punctuation is breathing and rests, and there's a lot that's the same.
But it's more than just a judicious use of adjectives.
I personally prefer to avoid adjectives. Verbs are much more powerful.
There's a section in the book where you talk about going to Austria and meeting the man who makes the soundboards for the Grotrians.
Right. It's actually in Pocking, Germany, is where his factory is. It's Strunz Soundboard.
Because I was able to, through your writing, I was able to really get a sense of the ambience of that terrain.
Well, I try to imagine that I'm leading a blind reader by the hand, which is what I'm doing. They can't see anything. And I have to describe everything for them because they can't imagine it otherwise.
But it brings up, for me, it brought up a visceral response.
Oh.
Do you find that to be common with good writing?
Tell me more about your response.
Well, I could smell the wood. I could smell the forest.
Oh, yeah.
I could...
That's what you want.
See the color of the light.
You've just told me I achieved what I set out to do.
Oh,
thank
good.
You.
Well, you're most welcome. But I mean, it's a puzzle to me, as I'm a person who is learning about writing, about how one does that.
Well, you try to avoid cliches.
Yeah.
You try to find words that say what you want to say in a way that's surprising. You try to be succinct. You try to describe what you know the reader can't imagine rather than what he can already figure out for himself. But I would say that to start writing that way is not a good process. It's a clear path to writer's block to keep those things in mind when you're writing, in my opinion. I prefer to simply write it and let it be as bad as it... In fact, sometimes I sit down and deliberately try to write a bad chapter. I write as badly as I possibly can, because do all the cliches, do all the obvious things, break all the rules, and just get it out, because you have all the time in the world to go back and make it better. and make it sing and make the words just the right words and the phrases shaped just perfectly. You have plenty of time to do that.
So you really are an advocate of revision.
Oh, that's the best part. Getting it down is the hard part.
Yeah. And you actually wrote some of this book in Point Reyes Station, didn't you? Or is that... Tell us about the chapter in Point
Reyes. There's
a
chapter that takes place in Point Reyes. At the time, when my piano journey first began, during that first year I was taking lessons, I was invited to be a resident at Mesa Refuge, which is owned by Peter Barnes and is a place for writers who write about the intersection of the environment and the economy to come and work. And I was granted a month-long stay, which is about twice as long as they usually have. And I had just started learning piano again and was petrified of losing the small gains I had made. My very first objective when I arrived at the house was to find a piano to practice on. And a church in town very kindly allowed me to have a key to their sanctuary where there was an old grand piano, and I went there every day to practice. And I had a quite powerful spiritual experience in that sanctuary because of that piano and because of my struggles with Mozart and trying to learn a sonata there. And so there's a chapter in the book called A Lesson with Mozart that takes place in that church and at the Mesa Refuge.
So you found that time and experience quite useful.
It was a very powerful time, and it really changed the direction of my own writing.
So I wanted to ask also about, has your deepened awareness about pianos and piano technology informed your piano playing and perhaps even your writing?
Yeah, I would say so. It's informed my piano playing in that I don't get all worked up about my piano not being perfect anymore. I allow it to be what it is because it's going to change again within an hour. And I didn't understand that at the beginning. I thought something was wrong. I thought pianos were static. I didn't realize they were living, breathing things. And so that's very helpful because it enables me to focus on the music and not get so hung up in the instrument. As far as my writing goes, I think this concept that I learned about technology, where if you tune a piano and you tune it again and you tune it again, that you then cross over into something that is an experience that's almost indescribable, that you can do the same thing with writing. You can refine it and refine it and refine it until it becomes a more integrated structure until it crosses over into something. It's like taking a crystal and turning it into a diamond. So I came to really believe in that process.
And have you found your own playing coming up then to that capability?
Well, unfortunately, my own playing has really suffered in the process of writing the book because I discovered that in expending the amount of mental capital I have to write at the level of intensity I was writing at, I was pretty well mentally exhausted by the end of the day and not able to practice effectively. I had to take a break from studying the piano while I was writing the book. A sad irony.
Because it's interesting, you said in your presentation last night that it takes the same effort to write as it does to play.
To practice. I played for enjoyment. And
I see this distinction.
Yeah. I was not, the level of attention one has to give to improving and practicing effectively is very mentally exhausting. I mean, most effective practice I've found is to do it for about 15, 20 minutes, then go do something else, then come back. It's like hitting the reset button on your brain. And writing is often the same thing. I mean, you might write for a stretch and then find yourself wiped out and you have to go pull weeds out in the garden. And then when you've refreshed, you can come back again. But you can really drain yourself physically with that much mental exertion. In fact, my editor kept warning me to eat well because I was going to drain all my energy if I didn't take care of myself physically.
That's fascinating. I mean, it really brings it home because many people think, oh, writing is so easy, or playing the piano, you just go over and play, right? But the amount of effort that goes into the fine motor control and the process of allowing that music to flow through you, and a good writer becomes transparent to their own ideas?
That's an interesting idea. The writer becomes transparent?
How does good writing show up, even when you're just downloading it?
How does it show up?
Yeah.
It shows up by being a clear channel.
And how do you do that?
Practice. It's really a spiritual practice. You know, writing a book is very hard work. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. And some days like laying concrete blocks. It's very, one foot in front of the other, a slow, blind slog. You don't know where you're going or if you're ever going to get out of there. And there were days when I was ready to give up. And I had a hike that I did. I would walk along Rattlesnake Creek in the wilderness area near town.
Because you live in Montana.
I live in Montana. And this is a pure wild creek. Flows over these beautiful belt rock, multicolored stones. And I would sit there and just let the creek talk to me and sort of bring me back to center. And when I would do that, some days I had to do that every day to get my center back. When I would do that, and I was a clear channel again myself, I would come to understand that writing the book was my spiritual practice and that it was forging me. It was like a forge where I was being refined into something else and being transformed.
And that's what you speak about happens with pianos, too.
Yes.
When they're tuned. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement. And we're talking with my guest, author Perry Nyes. And Perry has written a book called Grand Obsession. And how can people contact you, Perry?
I have a contact form on my website, grandobsession.com. And if you fill that out, it goes straight to my email. And on that site, you'll find a synopsis of the book and some excerpts and reviews and news and events and lots of other things.
And Grand Obsession is one word.
GrandObsessionOneWord.com.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back, so stay tuned. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement. And we're here talking with my guest, Perry Nyes, who has written a book about finding her piano called Grand Obsession. And before the break, Perry, you were talking about in the writing process of the book, you'd have to go out to the creek and kind of reconstitute. How did you come to be in Montana?
In 1983, I applied to work for the Forest Service. I had always had this dream of being a fire lookout when I was in high school. And they didn't have fire lookouts anymore, but they use radar now, but they had volunteer positions of various kinds, and I was offered a job as a wilderness guard in the Anaconda Pintler Wilderness, and it involved living alone on top of the Continental Divide for 5 months, just me and my dog, Sam, and it was about 7 miles straight uphill from the nearest dirt road at about 9,000 feet. Nearest supermarket was 100 miles away, and I spent 5 months up there. And I came to know people in Montana, and I learned about, that was the beginning of my becoming an environmental reporter. I learned about the Forest Service forestry program, which shocked me. And I decided that the public needed to know about this. Some people become journalists because they want to write. I became a journalist because I wanted to provide a public service. I wanted people to know things they deserved to know about in public policy. So the writing was kind of secondary at that time. But I ended up following the path that eventually I published a major article in the Atlantic Monthly called The Mismanagement of the National Forests, which brought on congressional hearings. And basically, according to the editor who put it in his anthology, said that article brought the Forest Service to its knees. Jack Ward Thomas told me personally it was the worst thing that ever happened to the agency. He didn't realize that he was talking to the author of the article when he said that. But
And that was the head of the Forest Service.
He was the head of the Forest Service. And it changed the timber program. I and many other people who were also writing about it at that time, there was kind of a groundswell that brought public attention to this.
Because there was a lot of clear-cutting going on without regard to watershed or...
That's right. That's right. It was a disaster. And I was horrified. I was only 27 years old when I had that season with the Forest Service, and I had idealistic visions about what the national forests were, having come from the East. And I was shocked and horrified to find out what was really going on. So it was out of a sense of outrage that I became a reporter. So my initial career was to be a muckraker. And, you know, the quality of the writing was kind of secondary. That was something that actually, it was in that scene at the Mesa Refuge, not only did I learn something about how to approach the piano differently, but that lesson taught me how to approach writing differently. It was no longer sort of this angry, try to, you know, fix what's wrong with the world. It was more about expressing beauty. It was about receiving inspiration and sharing it freely. It was a completely different orientation. And what happened was, as I had come to Mesa Refuge to write a book about wilderness management and wilderness policy, and I had spent 10 years researching the subject, and I had sent 7 boxes of books out, UPS, and my research files all piled up to begin this process over the course of a month. I came back from the church after having this transcendent, remarkable, life-changing experience playing this Mozart sonata. And the next morning, I woke up and I shoved all those boxes into a corner and I covered them with a tablecloth. And I went back to writing the novel I began when I was 6.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Did you finish it?
It's still
in progress.
In progress. Well, yeah, it's still in progress.
But what a shift.
Well, something deeper was calling to me that was beyond this sort of... I think on an emotional level, there were some things going on. One was I sort of let go of this self-punitive thing that I had sort of inherited from my father, and I was going to let go of that. I was going to live my life differently. And that meant giving up being angry.
And, ooh, that's big.
And to be an environmental reporter, you get pretty pissed off, and I was tired of being angry. I wanted to write about things that were beautiful. I wanted to inspire people. I wanted to bring forth beauty in the world, which is the same thing that motivates most piano technicians, I think.
So we're coming back to the piano, but I wanted to ask about, what did you find your relationship with the wilderness was in terms of informing you about beauty?
Well, the wilderness experience I had was deeply, profoundly therapeutic. We could do a whole other show about that. In fact, I'm probably going to end up writing a book about that. But it was a place to heal. And I think it's interesting to me that, you know, what also was going on with the piano and those of us who become so fascinated by tone and so needy of having a particular kind of tone and to have this transcendent experience with music, it's also about healing. They're both healing arenas. The piano is a place to heal, and the wilderness is a place to heal.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you.
Yeah.
So now we come back to the piano, and why a Grotrian? Because you have ended up with a Grotrian Steinweg.
Right.
And if you can tell us in a relatively short amount of time, how did you come to find, and that's who Marlena is. Mm-hmm. She's a 6'3" Grotrian Steinweg. You said she was a cabinet grand.
Right. That's the name of the model. It's 192 centimeters, which is about 6'3". So it's a chamber music size performance piano. It's larger than a baby grand and smaller than a concert grand.
But why a Grotrian, and how did you find her?
Well, I had been shopping for about 2 years for a piano, and I had started out wanting to buy a $1,500 used upright, just something to practice on. I was an adult beginner. I did not have grandiose ideas about finding the perfect piano at all. And over the course of time, my budget kept going up, $3,000, $5,000, $8,000. I was going to spend $10,000 for a new upright. And there are some very good uprights for that kind of money. And I had pretty much settled that I was going to get a Petrov upright piano for about that much. And then the dealer kept, you know, selling out of them. And so that same visit to New York where that dealer was, I stumbled into a shop called Beethoven Pianos. And I really did not understand what it was I was looking for. I mean, why couldn't I just buy a piano that would hold a tune and all the keys work? I mean, what is the big deal? Why am I not willing to pull the trigger on any of these pianos? I mean, just get a nice, basic, serviceable upright like a Charles Walter or a Yamaha U1. These are very good,
great pianos.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with them. But, you know, they weren't moving me. And I really did not understand myself what it was I was looking for until I played this Grotrian Steinweg Grand at Beethoven's. And then, you know, it was like the heavens opened. And, it was this. Now, how did I even know something like that existed? I don't know. Something in me had an inner vision of tone and refused to give it up. Refused to compromise on it, even though I wasn't consciously aware that that was the process I was in the middle of, but that was what was happening.
And then you met her and you fell in.
I fell in deep because the piano was $32,000 and there was no way I could buy that.
That's a little different than $1,500.
That's a little different.
So then what? What did you do?
Well, I resigned myself that I was never going to own that piano and left New York without it and never thought I would. I thought, well, you know, maybe I will get a grand piano. I could rearrange my living room so that it's possible to fit a grand piano, but I'll get a used piano. I'll get a used grand and maybe I can afford that a little better. And I was about to set off on a trip to Seattle to look at some used Grotrian grands. But Beethoven Pianos had a very, very persistent salesperson.
Yes, tell us about him. He's a pretty interesting character.
Yeah, his name is Asaf Blasberg. He only worked at Beethoven's long enough to meet me and sell me that piano, which took about 3 or 4 months, and then he was out of there. He is a really fine young concert artist, a recent graduate of Juilliard, very, very talented virtuoso. Virtuoso playing, absolutely. And he was determined and hungry, and he was going to get, he saw the look, he said, I saw the look on your face when you played that piano. That's your piano. And I said, you're right, but it doesn't make any difference because I can't afford it. And he pursued me for a month. He called me every week. And we would just have the same ridiculous conversation over and over again. And I would laugh. I started thinking it was hilarious, you know. You're wasting your time, you know. Anyway, I don't want to spoil the story of how it was actually possible for me ultimately to get the instrument, because that's a whole journey in and of itself.
But then the piano shows up in your home in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And then what?
Well, I lifted the fallboard and sat down with great anticipation and played, and it wasn't the same piano I'd played in New York.
Same serial number.
Had the same serial number. I double-checked it, and it was dead. Treble was dead, and I had specifically put in my shopping notes, gorgeous treble. Treble was dead. It sounded horrible. It was weird and echoey, and I brought in numerous technicians, talked to lots of people. Nobody could solve the problem.
And then,
so I went off on a journey to understand what was wrong with my piano, how to get that sound back, and then also to understand what was wrong with me, that I had hocked my house for a piano, and which is how I was able to buy it. My husband is, for all intents and purposes, deaf and has no musical training or background. And so, of course, he could not understand at all my fascination or what I was experiencing. And when I came back from New York and said, well, I found my piano, and I told him about the Grotrian, he said to me, well, do you want the Grotrian or do you want a larger house? I mean, we lived in a teeny, tiny little house, still live in it, 2 bedrooms, 1 bath. He has a gigantic son who comes and spends summers with us. We were really cramped in that house. And we'd been looking for a bigger house. He said, you want the Grotrian or you want a bigger house? And I said, that's easy. And he turned white. And he said, you are scaring me. But lucky for me, it was my house.
Yes, yes. And there's always room for a grand piano.
There's always room for a grand piano. My teacher said she'd had grand pianos in smaller spaces than my living room. So.
Yes. Yes, well, I speak that way from being a piano technician myself. There's always room for a grand piano in your bedroom, even if you have to sleep under it.
Anyway, I was very lucky, and my dealer, Carl Demler, believed me when I told him something was wrong, and he sent his technician, Mark Wienert, all the way out.
We did.
On an epic journey to come and salvage the piano. And Mark said to me, if I make the piano just what it was in the showroom, will you be happy? And I said, what a question, of course. So he comes out and he makes the piano just what it was in the showroom. It was even better than I remembered from the showroom. It was the most magnificent instrument that ever graced the planet. I was not its owner. I was its custodian. No one could own a piano like that. It was just its own entity. And it was fantastic, incredible. And I thanked Mark and I thanked Carl. And I woke up the next morning, rushed to my piano to play it again. And it was just as dead as before Mark came. Everything he'd corrected was back. Just the way. And so I went off on this epic journey, which becomes what the book is about, to discover what it was that was the difference between the piano that moved me and the piano that left me cold. What was that technically? And to find out what it was that had happened to me, and I soon discovered it happened to many other people. Why was I in the thrall of a piano? Why was I turning my life upside down for a piano? And why were other people doing this? I mean, I discovered an entire international subculture of people who had this experience with a piano and it changed their lives. What's that all about?
Yes, well, we're going to have to take a short break, so if you want to hear what Perry has to say about that, you'll have to stay tuned. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're talking with my guest, Perry Nyes, who has written a book called Grand Obsession. And how can people contact you, Perry?
They can go to my website, grandobsession.com. That's all one word, grandobsession.com, and go to the contact form and write to me, and it goes to my email.
And that's Grand Obsession is one word.
That's right.
Well, I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're going to take a short break and be right back, so stay tuned. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're here talking with my guest, Perry Nyes, and Perry has written a book called Grand Obsession. And before the break, Perry, you were talking about discovering what was it about this piano that had you in such thrall. So tell us about what you discovered. You said that there was a whole community of people who were enthralled by pianos.
Yes. Well, there's an online community that I became a part of called Piano World. And you get to it by going to pianoworld.com. And you go to the forums, and there you will discover 28,000 and growing people from all over the world who get together every day and discuss pianos obsessively. And I had joined their ranks during my piano search. And they provided kind of my guides. They were my guides along the way. And I made lots of wonderful friendships. And we started meeting on our travels and having piano parties and get together and have a lot of food and wine and play. And
but you were on a search for a technician.
I was
among
on a
other things.
I was on this. At that juncture, yes, I was on a search for a technician. I had concluded that what Mark didn't last, but I needed to understand what he had done to my piano, so I went to New York and hung out with him and watched him work.
As I also want to say to you, I was working in San Francisco for Sherman Clay, who was the Steinway dealer in San Francisco, and I've heard of you through the technician grapevine about, oh, there's this woman in Montana who wants somebody to come and look at her piano.
I went at it like a reporter. I used my reporting skills to try to find the right technician, and I began by asking certain people who had been recommended to me, who would they recommend? And that person would give me, say, five or six names, and then I would call those people, and they would give me five or six names. And pretty soon I was talking to every major technician in the country. And piano technicians who happened to be coming through town all would come and knock on my door. They wanted to try their hand at reviving Marlena. And it was kind of like the Sleeping Beauty story, the parade of princes who would come through. Would they be the ones to waken the beauty from her sleep? And they all want, you know, technicians, you know this, all like to be the hero. And so they were all, I would come back from interviewing these guys on the phone or, you know, from New York or something after talking to lots of these guys. And my husband and I would laugh because they were all vying with each other to be the hero, the one who saved the piano. And it was very touching but also very amusing to us because we were new to that world.
Yes, that's right.
But one technician, Daryl Fondrick, who was coming through, he practically forced his way into my house because he wanted to work on the piano so badly.
Oh, my goodness.
But he did a beautiful job, but yeah. Then it died again immediately.
Did you come to understand what was happening then?
Yes, I did.
So what did you discover?
You're going to have to read the book.
Ah.
Because the book is kind of a piano mystery thriller.
And
the discovery of what it was that had created this experience is the climax of the story. And if I tell you, it will give it away.
No.
Because it's something very surprising. And one of the things I took great delight in as I was writing it is that I thought even the technicians will be sifting through all the clues like it's a murder mystery, trying to figure it out and guess what the answer is going to be. It's like a piano technician's, you know, mystery story. And I'm very interested as I meet new piano technicians who've read the book to see, did they figure it out before I reveal the answer? And most of them didn't.
Really?
Yeah. Some of them say they did, but, you know, I haven't had the ability to ask them, you know, early in the story, what do you think it is? And then find, you know, because they can always say later, oh, I knew that.
Yeah. Well, in the process of this discovery, in a way, you go around the world, or at least to Europe anyway, to discover the basis of piano making in the West. What were some of the things that really are fundamental to your understanding of piano making in the West that you discovered in this journey?
Well, I was sent on that journey because I started going in the direction of talking to scientists and neurologists.
Like Manfred Kleins and let's see.
Milford Graves is a jazz drummer who was given a Guggenheim Foundation grant to study heart research in his basement lab in his house in Jamaica, Queens.
Cardiac research.
Yeah, and he has no medical training. He had been a lab technician at one time, but he's a jazz drummer. And the New York Times did a story about him, and I said, I need to go talk to this guy because he's healing human hearts by composing music that corrects heart arrhythmias. And I thought, here's someone who understands the effect that music has on our physiological system, because I pretty much had determined from talking to medical people that there was an actual physiological phenomenon that was going on, that was being triggered. So, you know, I'm that naive that there was almost nothing. I knew almost nothing about my experience, so I had to sort of start from ground zero.
But you came to it with the trained eyes and ears and awareness of a reporter, which
right.
is really what we find in this book.
I went after like a reporter. I was an investigative reporter now to understand my own experience. And so I went to Milford Graves and asked him, what is it, as I asked many, many people over and over again in the book, what is it I experienced when I fell in love with my piano? And that's what the whole central question the book seeks to answer is, what is it we are seeking when we fall in love with a piano? And so he said to me, you are experiencing the intention of everyone who ever worked on that piano, the person who built the belly, the person who cut the tree, the person who designed it, the person who tuned it, the person who voiced it. Their intention as human beings are embodied in that instrument, and that's what you are resonating to. And so that was a very intriguing idea to me, and I said, who are these people? And I went to Europe to meet them. So I went to the forest in Austria where they cut the trees and learned about tone wood forestry, which after my reporting experience about American forestry was very interesting to me.
I'll bet.
I learned that trees that you use to build pianos must grow under incredibly exacting conditions. They have to be on a slope that's at exactly the right grade. It has to face exactly the right way. It has to be at just the right narrow level of elevation. They have to have grown from seed on the site from the parent trees. They can't have been transplanted. It has to be a native forest. There are many, many little tiny requirements. And then even of those trees, only maybe 2-3% have the right qualities necessary for a piano soundboard. And then of those trees, only 2-3% of the tree is usable for building soundboards. So, and there are only 4 places in the world that grow trees like this. In Austria, Italy, Bavaria, and Switzerland. It's all in the middle European Alps where these conditions are that grow this white spruce. So I learned about tonewood forestry from the Austrian Forest Service forester, and he's quite passionate about what he does. He makes sure they cut exactly the right tree in each stand. I met the roundwood dealer who buys trees for tonewood. I went to the soundboard factory where the soundboard for my piano was made by a company that's been in the same family for 7 generations. The company was started in 1805, and that was a remarkable experience, and they were remarkable people. And all along the way, these were remarkable people. I fell madly in love with the characters I met over and over again, and I think thinking that my readers will fall in love with these people too. They're yes. passionate. They love what they do. They themselves are vibrating as beings on a very elevated frequency. And we resonated to each other when we met.
And that finally, after all is said and done, particularly when Mark came to visit, Marlena showed up in Marlena and then showed up in you.